I'm Marcus Smith for The Morning Show. You know, here on this program, we have a regular opportunity to interview all sorts of interesting people. And just imagine if you were in my shoes. You get to come to work each morning. You don't know who you're going to talk with necessarily. It could be a professor of political science, or it could be somebody who owns a missile silo, or it could be somebody who's running for the president of Mali. It could be a creator of a comic strip. It could just, and I'm just really, really lucky to be able to, and you are too, to be able to get to hear these people who are fascinating people. They talk about things they care about and they're passionate about them, and we try to get some real expertise as well. Well, right now we've got some expertise in a segment featuring our producer Kylan Rice, visiting with Professor Dan Bloomstein. Dan Bloomstein is chair of the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at UCLA. And I think you're going to find in this interview that it's a bit of a grab bag interview. And I love this kind of interview where it seems on the face of it, like you say, these things are unrelated. But then you find out, oh no, they're all connected. And people who are not only specialists, but also have the capacity to be generalists, that is to say, they have the capacity to be interdisciplinary in their scholarship, they can come up with amazing ideas, and they'll connect all the dots for you. So here we have a conversation with Professor Dan Bloomstein on subjects that range from movie soundtracks to evolution to dinner parties. I want to see how this happens.
Professor Dan Bloomstein, pleasure to have you with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Great. We're going to be talking a little bit today about how we experience emotion collectively, sometimes through sound, and then we'll move on to talking about another social subject concerning civility. First off, I understand that you've spent some time researching film soundtracks and how they affect us emotionally. I'm curious, what initially got you interested in this line of inquiry?
So I study animal behavior, and I spend an inordinate amount of time out in the field listening to what animals say, particularly marmots. Marmots are big ground squirrels and live around the northern hemisphere. Groundhogs are an example of a marmot species. And I noticed one day while holding a baby marmot within about 8 or 9 days of emergence from its natal burrow where it was born, gently holding it, not hurting it, it screamed. And I almost dropped it. And that scream, and I was really surprised by this, because that scream was something that I hadn't really heard marmots give before, and it really affected me emotionally, and I wondered why. When I hear birds singing, I'm not emotionally affected. When I hear alarm calls, which animals do when they detect predators, I don't have that same emotional response. So I started reading in the literature a lot and listening to other animals, and what I found was that when animals are particularly terrified or in some situations, they scream. And these screams sound like they're very similar. Mammalian screams are noisy, and their frequency varies quite a bit, and they have abrupt frequency changes. And all of these acoustic characteristics are defined in the bioacoustic literature as examples of non-linear vocal phenomena. So what's that mean? That means that a sound production system, or other systems really, when you turn up the volume on your stereo, it gets louder and louder and louder until it goes nonlinear, until it gets distorted, until it sounds bad. And that's sort of the same sort of thing that happens when a mammal is blowing air from its lungs through its vocal cords, vibrating its vocal cords and producing a sound. If it overblows them, it gets noisy and unpredictable and distorted. So what I then started looking at emotionally evocative sounds that animals were making, they seemed to be noisy, that other people had reported this as well. Meerkats, for example, as meerkats get involved in more urgent situations with predators, their alarm calls get noisier. Other species as well. Barking dogs, I mean, you all know the sound of a bark and then a real bark. Baby cries. We all know the sound of babies crying, and then when they're really upset and really crying. And these are noisier. They're very evocative to us. So I was talking to people and giving a public talk about this, and I said, you know, I live in Los Angeles, and I said, I bet this applies for movie soundtracks and music. And afterwards, a guy came up to me and introduced himself. His name was Peter Kay. Peter's a film score composer, but he also has been studying how emotions are conveyed in music and film. And he said, I bet you're right. And he goes, what's nice about this is, if you're right, I mean, it's sort of a very biologically based reason for why we respond certain ways to things. So Peter and I, and an undergraduate at UCLA, looked at a whole bunch of films, and we characterized them as being, we sort of looked at adventure films, and we looked at sad dramatic films, and we looked at horror films and war films, and we sort of looked at key scenes in those films, and we looked for the presence or absence of a variety of noise and other sorts of these nonlinear phenomena. What we found was they were biased according to film genre, and that horror films have more noisy female screams than you would expect, and sad dramatic films don't, and things like that. And I said, well, that's really cool. This sort of suggests that there's a correlation, there's an association between film genre and the use of these noisy things. And I said, but that's correlative. Let's get experimental. And I was talking to a colleague and friend here, Greg Bryant, who's a professor in UCLA's Department of Communication Studies, and he studies how emotions are conveyed in humans, voice and other sounds, and also he's a musician. So Peter and Greg got together and composed a bunch of soundtracks, and we then asked people how they felt when they heard various types of music, and I'll call this marmot-inspired music, music that had specific types of noise and other non-linearities added to them. And what we found was that people rate noise as being more arousing and less positive. In other words, the valence is reduced, and that other non-linearities had similar sorts of effects. So what I've concluded from this is that, and right now Peter and I, or Greg and I, are trying to look at autonomic nervous system responses. We're looking for how people really are responding to these things rather than asking them what they think. But at the end of the day, it does seem that by listening to my inner marmot, by going out and seeing and listening to what animals and how animals are communicating, that we've gained some insight into why we respond to certain sounds as we respond to them.
Yeah, and I'm interested. I'm interested in this response. Why are we so attuned to these oral experiences? Why do they affect us so?
Because I think that in other animals there are good reasons why these sounds are produced in particularly dire situations, and that so animals can produce sounds, but for communication to occur, other animals have to pay attention to them, or people. People can produce sounds, but other people have to pay attention to them. And it seems that these are honest indicators that the individual producing them is in some form of duress. So it would behoove listeners, particularly in anti-predator contexts, it would behoove listeners to pay attention to these things. They're very evocative. I don't know what the sound of joy is. I don't know what the sound of sadness is. But I do know that what the sound of arousal or fear is, and it does seem to be that it's that all of these, you know, animals share the ability to produce these things under duress. There are similar sorts of sounds, and that animals pay attention to other animals under duress.
Other people have said that sometimes what's scarier or more intense in a horror film, for instance, is the lack of sound.
Yeah, you know, in Jaws, the shark came out when there was no sound.
Yeah.
But that's true. And film actually is interesting because part of the experiment that we did with composing music, we also made some soundtracks. And we were looking at this in what we would call a multimodal way, or video tracks. We looked at this in a multimodal way. Not only do we have soundtracks, but we had video. And we made those things and paired them in certain ways. And it's a little more confusing because sounds alone are perceived differently than sounds with video. And we're trying to understand that more fully right now. And certainly, scary things can be surprising, in which case people actually scream. But scary things can also be enhanced by that background music.
I'm also interested in the application of something like this. Maybe you have some insights into how in other areas of society or media, an evolutionary biological response is manipulated to generate an experience.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that fear-mongering in politics is a good way to tap into our need for security, our desire to be secure. I would say an evolutionary approach to security. I work with a group of people where we're developing what I'll call a field of natural security. We're trying to understand lessons from 3.5 or 6 billion years of life for security, defense, broadly speaking. And one of those lessons is you can't eliminate all risk, that all animals have always traded off safety versus other things they've had to do, that it's impossible to be perfectly safe. If you're perfectly safe, you never leave your home, and if you never leave your home, you're never going to get the benefits of leaving your home, which might include food or other sorts of things. So all animals have to trade off risk. All animals have to be prepared to manage and deal with risk, but we're very sensitive towards overestimating risk in many situations, and certainly people in the media tap into that to manipulate, or politicians tap into that to manipulate our behavior, I think.
Now, to change subjects somewhat ungracefully, I'm also interested in your research into the loss of civility in modern America, or your research into civility. You've noted that your book, The Failure of Environmental Education and How We Can Fix It, was inspired by civility and the dinner party. I'm wondering if you could talk about that connection.
Sure. So I've written a book with a friend and colleague, Charlie Salen, called The Failure of Environmental Education and How We Can Fix It. And what we view, our perspective is that we find ourselves in a very polarized society right now, and that ultimately this isn't good for us dealing with some of the big problems we think we face as a society, that aren't red or blue issues, but rather influence us all. And we think that dealing with pollution and overfishing and toxification of our earth and climate-related issues are huge things that will affect us all, and that we really need to work together to improve. Charlie and I argued for years over a series of dinner parties before we put together our book, The Failure of Environmental Education and How We Can Fix It. And I sort of had the insight somewhere during this process of writing the book and continuing to cook and argue and talk and learn from people, is that we have to break down these barriers, and that modern, you know, just look at this last election cycle, that we've lost the ability to listen and learn and respect other people's opinions, and that's not good, and that's not good for our future. And that I wrote a book called Eating Our Way to Civility, A Dinner Party Guide, which is a greenish book in the sense that I think over meals you can begin talking and sharing and learning about greenish perspectives, which go all the way from food choices and what foods one's eating and the consequences of factory farming or industrial farming or overfishing fisheries or decisions about eating meat versus eating other things. It also includes a bunch of recipes, and it also tries to suggest that maybe by, you know, breaking the bread, that's the first step towards breaking the ice, that we can learn and listen about what people's real issues are and concerns are, and that maybe we'll find that, you know, maybe one person identifies as red and another identifies as blue, but really we share many of the same concerns about our children and our children's children, and that by doing that, maybe we can begin to work towards addressing some of these things. I mean, for example, I think the evidence for climate change is irrefutable, but what one does and what one considers ethical and moral involves people and involves decisions, and you only create morals and ethics by talking and listening and learning from others.
And I'm also curious how, you know, who defines civility, and how do you argue that America is losing it? Where were we, and could you describe the descent?
You know, people talk about the 1800s and the sort of really polarized politics in the 1800s. You know, politicians have fought to duels before, so I mean, clearly that's a loss of civility. But when you have personalized news and personalized networks yelling at each other and not being particularly polite towards people who may have other positions, I don't think that's very civil. And I think it's spread over onto how many people respect or don't respect other people's views. And I think that, you know, people have views, and we have to understand different views, and may not agree with those different views, but we have to respect those different views. Maybe there's some views I don't respect, but I try to understand where people are coming from with many views. But I think most people would sort of point out that we're probably at a low point in terms of trying to respect other people's views right now, between talk radio and various cable news channels. And it goes both ways. It's not, I'm not pointing fingers at, you know, one particular party or not.
Sure. Just to wrap things up, you mentioned your book, Eating Our Way to Civility, A Dinner Party Guide. Just for, you know, kicks, I'm wondering if you could talk about maybe a favorite recipe that you included in there.
So I've been blogging, although I've been depressed about our lack of civility during our election cycle, so I've haven't been blogging much recently. But I blog new recipes and discussion topics, and these days I've also been posting things that I think are interesting that people might want to look at. So it's sort of an ongoing exercise. But figs. I live in Southern California, and when in the fall when it's fig season, you know, I eat figs. But you can cook figs as well, and just caramelizing them brings out all those sugars and is really easy. And then adding a little bit of basil and a little bit of cayenne and a little bit of mustard seed and a little bit of lemon, particularly Meyer lemon, which I'm sort of fascinated with these days, really pulls those flavors together really nicely. So warm figs is something that these days I try to eat as much as I can, or certainly when they're in season. A lot of the recipes in the cookbook are kind of easy to make. I like having the theme of the cookbook and a theme of my own dinner parties is sort of tapas style. Lots of little bites of things. And this serves a number of uses. One, I like cooking and I like that first bite you get from eating something. But also, if the party's going south and the conversation's going south, you can always say, oh, let me bring out the new dish. Let's introduce this new dish. Another thing that I've been cooking a lot these days is tilapia. Fishes, most fisheries are overfished. Most fisheries are not sustainable. And, I think your older listeners can remember halibut steaks that you used to buy 30 years ago, which were huge. The average size of the halibut is much, much smaller now, which means that we're catching younger and younger fish. And ultimately, that's not sustainable for long-lived fish like halibut. So the challenge then is, well, what can you eat if you want to eat seafood and really or fish? And the answer really is farmed fish, but not all farmed fish. So salmon, when you farm salmon, you have to go out and hunt wild fish to feed the salmon, which doesn't really make a lot of sense. So wild-caught salmon can be a sustainable fishery in some places. But tilapia can be raised far inland from water bodies, so it's not going to pollute natural water bodies. Tilapia eat algae, so they're plant eaters, and by doing so, these can be raised in a rather sustainable way. So I've been playing around with tilapia recipes and trying to make tilapia taste really good, and I've been playing, you know, there are a number of them in the cookbook, and I've blogged some newer ones that I've been playing around with as well.
Professor Dan Blumstein, thank you so much for speaking with us about your ideas and for making us all hungry with your recipes. Thanks again.
Thank you very much.
It's a great conversation between Kylan Rice of our staff here at The Morning Show and Dan Blumstein, who is the chair of the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at UCLA. You know, you hear somebody like that talking and you suddenly realize to yourself, wow, there might still be a Renaissance man or two in the country. You know, he talks about evolutionary biology and horror film soundtracks, dinner parties, figs. Do we know that much anymore? Does anybody know? Just yesterday, I was trying to repair a swing set in my own backyard, and I looked at the humble little simple piece of hardware. We call it a bolt, and it fits in the nut. And I thought, somebody knows how to make these. Somebody actually knows how to make these. Must be a brilliant person. This is The Morning Show on Sirius XM 143 BYU Radio.